Okay, we're back. I think. Yes, we are. Okay.
All right, we're on. Okay, well, welcome back out there in video land. Today, in this section, we're going to talk about the Greek and Roman philosophers. And why do we talk about them? Because this is where learning starts. Okay? Primarily in Western civilization and assorted other things. Now, we could also talk about some of the great Chinese philosophers, and we could do that, but it doesn't impact our course the way the Greek and Roman philosophers did, so I don't really talk about that. But you should all go back and look at some of those great philosophers, Confucius and all the other ones. It's just great. Good stuff. Okay. All right, today, so let's talk about the Greek and Roman philosophers for a little bit. And when you talk about learning theory, this is kind of pretty much where it starts. All right. And so the first one that we really talk about in learning theory is Simonides. And Simonides is really the first person to point out the importance of organization and memory. And what happened with Simonides is something pretty simple. Simonides is kind of this philosopher of this time, and he's all, and so everybody, so the king invites them to this kind of banquet, all right? And they sit down, and they're all having this great food and whatever, and Simonides has to get up and go to the bathroom or something or other. So he gets up and he leaves. And after he leaves, the building collapses and everybody dies. Okay. Now, and of course there's a fire and, you know, all the good stuff, right? So all the bodies are unrecognizable. Okay. And so Simonides is called back and he goes, we need to bury the king and we need to make sure the body is right, right? You wouldn't want to bury some lowlife, you know, the servant that's over there, and put them in the king's casket and put the king out in the trenches somewhere, right? So we need to identify where the king is. And so Simonides, basically through an organizational scheme, is able to identify where all the people were at the table. And of course, all the correct people are put in the appropriate rich people's caskets, and they all go into the right holes in the ground, and all the rest of the people go into the ditch, right? Okay, and so he's really the first person to kind of point out the importance of how organization is really, really important in relation to memory. Over time, though, we have begun to have the classic philosophers that you know and love, and you have all read about, correct? No. You have not read about them because you haven't done any of this stuff. But you need to, all right? Because philosophy really, really is important in relation to psychology and in relation to a lot of things, okay? Okay, and the classic example is, quote, the only thing, one thing only I know, and that is I know nothing, okay? And the reason for that is that basically what philosophy for Socrates is that philosophy begins when you learn to doubt. That is, doubt your own particular cherished beliefs that are out there. So you believe that something should occur for some particular reason. Well, when you really begin to break through in science and you break through in philosophy and on and on and on, is when you challenge that belief. Is it really that? Is it really that? Or is it something else? Okay. We all used to know that the world was flat. Except for, you know, the Swedes and the Chinese and Japanese and Indonesians and everybody else who knew it was round. But the people in Western civilization thought it was flat, this big flat plain of a lake. If you went over there too far, what happened to you? You went off the edge, right? Okay. And of course, when you went off the edge, what happened to you? That's where the demons were, and everybody died. Okay. Well, of course, that wasn't the case. But when you cherish that, and when you examine that, you don't have those issues anymore. Okay. All right. Okay. So really, when there's no real philosophy, it's according to Socrates, is until the mind begins to examine itself, and the issue is know thyself. That is, in order for you to help somebody. Okay, for a lot of you want to go into clinical psychology of some sort or another. You have to know who you are in order to help others. Your strengths, your weaknesses, and on and on and on. If you have baggage, now's the time to deal with the baggage. When it's free, when you go to the counseling center, or whatever it may be, okay? But if you don't, but if you have all this baggage, if you have all these problems, it's pretty difficult for you to help others. And so knowing yourself, know your strengths, know your weaknesses, know what you think, know what you believe, on and on and on. And be consistent with that, and you become a much better person. Okay? So, really, really important, knowing yourself, and on and on and on. And that's really where, when we really start talking about philosophy, that's the first thing. Now, Socrates developed a learning style. And basically what it demanded was very accurate definitions, clear thinking, exact analysis, and on and on and on. And ultimately this became known as the Socratic method. And the Socratic method basically relied kind of on a questioning style. And so when I'm using the Socratic method, I'm not presenting to you like I'm talking to you right now. What I'm doing is asking you the questions. And from your information, we move forward to get the correct answer. So I give you cues, I may give you prompts, etc. If you were in my graduate, if you were a graduate student, well, let me freeze this. I'll take this back. I'll put it on me. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I had my mentor, who I love dearly. He was a wonderful guy. He's now retired. But I had him for a class on history of psychology. And so the first day we come in and we've all read the material. We're good graduate students. First year graduate students. We're good graduate students. So we've actually read the stuff, all right? Kind of have a little bit of an idea, read it the night before, read it in the morning before class, and we all come in and we're all excited, first day. And so he goes, Steve, tell me about X. And so I spit off a couple sentences and he goes, well, how does this relate to something else? And how did that relate to another kind of frame of thought? And so what am I doing? I'm struggling, right? Okay. And we struggled for an hour and a half. It was brutal. Okay. And when we got done, we went out and he goes, I'm very disappointed in you. So how big did I feel? Well, very, very small. But what happened on Thursday?
We were prepared.
Everybody walked in, we had pages of notes, we had the chapters outlined, we had lines going everywhere, and I wasn't the only one that got brutalized. Everyone in the class caught it. There was about 20 of us, and we all caught it. And he literally grilled us for an hour and a half on X, Y, and Z, asking us questions, expanding on whatever it is, defining things, on and on and on. And I still remember things from that class when I've forgotten a lot of other stuff, such as some of the intelligence stuff. Never mind, I'm not going to go there. Animal intelligence, whatever. But just forgot all of it, just flushed all that. Okay. But some of that stuff that he taught us was, I still remember. Okay. And we did get a book that was relatively easy about psychology. We got Turner. And Turner is like one of these books over here. Like this. And you can't see this very well on the computer or out there in video land, but all it is just small print. No pictures, no nothing, no outlines, just words. And so you have to make your own organization. And it was pretty amazing. So anyway, we all learned that. That's the Socratic method. Someday I'm going to come in here and I'm going to say, we're going to use the Socratic method of inquiry. and you're all going to groan because you better be prepared for it. So when you go on to graduate school, that is the norm. That's the expectation that you should have, not the exception. Okay? So something to think about. All right. So Socratic method. All right. Now, there are other people that come after Socrates, and the next one is Hippocrates. And Hippocrates, as we all know, is the father of medicine. And he develops a new method of inquiry, all right? And basically, instead of just talking about things and thinking about things, some of the other ones, the way you find out new information, says Hippocrates, is through careful observation and collect and interpret facts. And you can then incorporate that into all sorts of different things. And that's a really major advance over all the other particular methodologies of the time, which was faith and the gods and assorted other things that were going out around there, okay? Supernatural powers, etc. Okay? So basically what Hippocrates did was pioneer the application of basically systematically looking at information and facts and using that to study how humans behave, all right, and what they do. So that's kind of when you look at Hippocrates, that's kind of what you're thinking. Of course, for his time, he was extremely knowledgeable, all right? He's using detailed case histories, dissects dead bodies. He had a lot of dead bodies, right? Because we have the Greek wars, right? And the wars between the city-states and on, etc. One of the first groups of people to use dream analysis in a systematic manner. We talk about Freud and Jung primarily using dream analysis and assorted other things and all of that. This goes way back beyond that. And if you go back and look at the Chinese literature, it's even in there too. Okay, so, and he, of course, develops the Hippocratic Oath. Okay, and that sets the high standard for physicians that we even have today. All right. Next one, Plato. Plato's a nativist. He's the antithesis of Hippocrates. Basically, he believes that individuals have innate knowledge. You teach individuals using the Socratic method, questioning, bringing out the innate ideas, etc., by asking the right question. The key is you have it in there. You have that information in there. All I have to do is pull it out of you. If you pull it out of you, then you make sure that you understand it. All right? So, according to Plato, totally different from Hippocrates, all right? Different approach, all right? So, for Plato, the knowledge of the world existed in two forms, all right? Or in two worlds, all right? The knowledge of phenomena, which was your sensory world, and this is the model, this is the world where it's like shadows. The information is there, but you can't touch it, all right? And the world of forms, and the world of forms are basically ideas, all right? They're ideas inherent in every person. Freedom, that's an example of an idea, all right? And this world's unchanging, and it's known through reasoning, all right? You understand this through reasoning. You don't get this from experience, or you don't get this from some kind of sensory information. So you have this world of phenomena, which is the sensory world, and the world of forms. All right? Yeah.
Does this have to do with the cave?
So yeah, to a degree, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the classic example is if you have I can't do the pictures. Okay. But you have forms there, you can't touch it. Okay? The Night at the Museum is a good movie that has some of that. Okay? Not the dog, not the dinosaur that acts like a dog, right? With the bone, throw up the bone. Okay, so knowledge is truth, it's possession of the truth. But knowledge resides on reasoning, not sensory experience. And the key for Plato is that the brain is the seat of perception. Okay? The brain is the seat of perception. is unlike a lot of other people. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Okay. Next one, Aristotle. Aristotle totally disagrees with Plato.
Okay.
And their debates are well known through the information that's out there. And basically what Aristotle is going to be saying is something that we've already talked about a little bit, is that all knowledge comes from the senses and through experience. All right? And that your mind is like a blank writing tablet, a tabula rasa. And knowledge should be based on observations of the external world, not your internal world, not the reasoning and all the other stuff. You get knowledge based on the external world. That is what's out there. And he anticipates two major laws of learning that we still use today. The law of contiguity, that is, if two things are touching in space and time, one will bring the other to mind. Okay? Use the same limerick as what we use for the cranial nerves. Okay? So, two things are touching space and time, one will bring the other to mind. And this is a classic example of the laws of association. And so what we talk about in cognitive psychology is we talk about spreading activation and all those other kinds of things that you all heard about in introductory psych, all right? And that's the kind of classic stuff that you're talking about. Association. When one thing becomes is there, you associate with something else, all right? So the classic example is I have a can. Let's say I have a soft drink can, and I have it closed. I have it behind the screen, and I go, there's a soft drink over here, and I go, psh, what do I think about? I think about Coca-Cola. I don't think about Pepsi. I don't think about Dr. Pepper. I don't think about beer. I think about Coca-Cola. When I think about beer, I said the same kind of thing. Open it up, what do I think? What beer do people drink? Of course it's PBR. Hams, okay? Alright, okay. PBRs, right? PBR is back, I couldn't believe it. PBR used to be hot in my day. And a long time ago, when I was your age. When I was in the Navy, a long time ago, we would play softball. And we'd always in San Diego, and it would be hot as heck. So it was 80, 90 degrees at night. We're playing fast pitch softball. We would just take cases of PBR and put it in this great big trash can, 30-gallon trash can, and load it up with ice. And it would sit there when we played softball. Then we were done. Then we would drink the beer, drink all the beer. Oh, God. There's a lot of beer in a 30-gallon can. I mean, 30-gallon trash can. But it was fun, right? Okay. But today, what would I drink? Hams, no. Waiter, okay. Okay, but if you, okay, so, but if those associations are the things that you are getting with, okay? So the two things, the tsh, and I have a recognition or association of that with something, I can market that, I can change that association, I can manipulate that to make you buy my particular product. Whatever that particular product is, okay? For youth today, 16, 17-year-olds, it's Monster. It's the energy drink, Monster, okay? That's what it's doing, that's what they do, okay? So, that's what it's out there. All right. And the second law, it's law of similarity and contrast. If two things are similar, one will bring the other to mind. If two things are opposite, one will bring the other to mind. So when I say the word black, you say the word white, okay? When I say the word chocolate chip, you say the word cookie, of course, there's no cookie, right? Okay? So when two things are similar, you start to develop these associations, etc. All right. Basically, like other people of his day, agreed with Hippocrates that mental illnesses come from physical causes. All right? And so there's some information there. So it's not just Freud that you've learned about. It goes all the way back in the physical causes. But he disagreed with Plato. And here's the big thing that's going to have a major impact on all of us. And that is the heart is the main organ of sensory existence, not the brain. Plato is the brain. Okay? Aristotle is the heart. And the brain for Aristotle was designed primarily to reduce heat. All right? So I want you to think about this. If you look at the brain, you cut open the brain, what do you see? See lots of little grooves and valleys, right? So, and if you actually feel the head, it's very hot. It's hotter than the rest of the part of your body because you get lots and lots of circulation there, all right? Stab somebody in the brain with a sword, they can still live. Stab somebody in the heart with a sword, you die, okay? So there's lots of explanations about why that particular thing could come to pass and why you could make that deduction that it is the heart that is really the most important thing in your life. And so, of course, you have all of the ritualistic things and all the other stuff that come from that. So Cupid's arrow doesn't shoot you in the brain. Cupid's arrow shoots you in the heart, right? And all these other kinds of things that go along with that. So that and that error lasts for another 1,500 years. Okay, major issue. All right. Okay, next people that come along, the Romans. Okay, so we've got the Greeks, and now we move into the Romans. All right, and the Roman Empire continues on with the Greeks of medicine and sort of other things because primarily the Greeks became slaves of the Romans, right? And we moved on with that. But basically, and there's lots of different Roman physicians out there, some of which are very, very good. And the ones one that I really want to hit on is Galen. And basically, a lot of historians consider after Galen dies, Rome basically tanks. It starts to tank. And he's used kind of as an indicator of what's going on. He's probably the most prolific and influential writer after Hippocrates, okay? And used a very strong experimental approach. And his writings become basically the dominant writings and the authoritative sources ultimately throughout, all the way through the Middle Ages. Okay, so lots and lots of strength from that. And some of his stuff we still use today, all right? Some of his findings we still use today. Especially in the visual system and some of the other things. The key for Galen was that you look at things scientifically. You're going to use an experimental approach, all right? And you investigate things in a way to analyze it, all right? And so what he does, what's his contribution? Well, he recapitulates the discoveries of Hippocrates. He does studies on animals, describes the muscles of the eyes and the brain, assigns the sensory nerves of the brain, contended the arteries are filled with blood, not air, and on and on and on. Okay? This guy's brilliant. So he wouldn't, in our day, he wouldn't probably just have one Nobel Prize. He would probably have a couple. Maybe three. That's how big his contributions were. And that's how much of an impact he had, not from just during his time, but even up until today. Okay? Continues, like other things, mental illness is to both physical and psychological factors. Talks about alcoholism, brain injury, traumatic brain injury, shock, okay, life experience, shocking life experiences, on and on and on. Huge impact, all right? So, Galen is when we talk about Galen, the impacts that he made is incredible. But the big thing you need to kind of understand, and really one of the things, although all those things are important, and kind of remember and understand what he did, the thing is, it's the approach. It's the approach that he takes to understanding what's going on within his environment. And that approach is a scientific approach. Observation, recording, analysis, those kinds of things. The same kind of things that we do today in experiments is what Galen was doing back in his time. And most of the people back in his time were not. It had to do with the gods. It then later had to do with Christianity and assorted other things. But it was not a scientific approach unless you were in that certain group of people. Big difference, okay? And those contrasts are really, really important. Okay? Quintilian, another major Roman philosopher, advocates theories that basically were implemented and have continued to be implemented in many schools. Okay? Use logical reasoning from premises to conclusions. The systematic repetition and recall of facts. We call that memorization. So there's no fuzzy math for Quintilian. There's no 1 and 1 is 3. Well, and that's okay. No, 1 and 1 is 2. Period. Okay? Mastery of the subject matter from simple to complex elements. So you start with the simple things. You move up and up and up and up until you master the something that's really, really difficult for you to do. Okay? Calculus. You can't learn calculus starting with calculus. You have to learn calculus starting with 1 plus 1 is 2. And then algebra and geometry and trigonometry and all the other good stuff that ultimately move into calculus. And you don't understand physics unless you understand math. Unless you understand chemistry. And if you don't believe me, take engineering physics without taking chemistry and math first. And you will discover how much you need to know before you get there. All right? One of the things that he did, which makes it a little different, is that he provided rewards, okay, for intellectual achievements. So if you did well, you got a smiley face. Okay, or you got money. Okay, it wasn't just the fact that you passed the class or you got a grade; you got something from that. And of course, what we know today is that when I reinforce you for doing a particular behavior, you do that more often and you do it better. Okay. So, providing reward and praise was really important. Practical free self-expression. Okay. Adaption of instruction to the interests and different capacities of the pupils. Okay? Some of you have a lot of information in here, know a lot of stuff. Some of you don't know squat. Okay? And so what I would do with my class is that I would adapt the class to each of you. Okay? Now that's great if I'm working with only you and that's all I'm doing the whole day. All right? But in today's environment, we can't do that. So we have to adapt to the norm, the me. Some of you get it better, some of you don't. Okay. And we move on from there. Okay. So it's a different expression than what we would ideally like to do in academia. That's what you do in graduate school. Okay. When you get into graduate school, you mentor your pupils. So you have 5 pupils. Those pupils follow you around everywhere, and they're learning from you and watching you, and you're giving them lots of feedback. That's what it's about. Okay? And so when people are working with me, that's what I'm trying to do for them. So I will be working with their writing. I'm finding out what's going on with them, and on and on and on. And that's what academic professors are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be working with their students, especially in grad students. Okay. All right. Roman Empire starts to go downhill, okay, and you start to get a rise in Christianity. And there's lots of different philosophers that we have in Christianity that's also part of the Roman Empire. And the classic example of that is Augustine. And basically, Augustine is believed that there was a distinction between the sensory world, and that is from the stuff from Plato, and a lot of the world of forms, okay? And he also, though, is embracing Christianity. He's a major Roman emperor, and he's embracing Christianity. He's the first one that really does that in a very specific and outgoing manner. And from this, he's got these conflicts. He's got the Christian philosophy and all the stuff that's going on with that. He's got some stuff, he's a well-learned person, okay, as emperor. And, of course, he knows the classics, the Greeks and the early Romans. And so, how do you combine those? Well, he develops a new model. And that new model is what we call Neoplatonism. New Platonism to reconcile the differences. What he does is incredible, and the impact that it will have is going to be huge. He changes Plato's ideas subtly. He basically takes the sensory world, which is known through the sensory organ, okay, and the shadows and all the other good stuff, and the intelligible world. But from the intelligible world, it's not known through the mind, a la through Plato. It's known through the soul. Okay? And the soul, all right? And this, so it's a very small step. Ultimate truth for Plato is found through reasoning. The ultimate truth for Augustine is found through faith. So if you don't have the faith, you don't have it. Okay? So even though something may be totally wrong, we believe through faith that isn't actually correct. Right. So for Augustine, he wants to know God and the soul, and think about it at the time. Jesus was supposed to come back at that particular time later, when everybody was still, you know, went relatively early, and that has not, that didn't happen. So basically, he's using faith to justify belief. And after Augustine dies, basically Neoplatonism is going to have an impact on everything up into the scientific revolution and the Renaissance, but mostly the scientific revolution. Okay, everything's part of God's world. Okay, and then Rome falls. Okay. So now, Christianity didn't cause Rome to fall. Rome fell because of its decadence, and it lost. It forgot what it was. Okay, and it basically. It became a socialist state, so people couldn't take it. Taxes couldn't do it. Caused lots of problems, etc. So, you know, and some of the basic things that go on with a lot of empires. But, and then when Rome fell, where do we move into? We move into the, come on, you history people, what happens? Rome falls, we move into the early Middle Ages, or what you'd also know as the Dark Ages. So, anyway, so we're going to start talking about that next time. So, the key that I want you to do, so for this next, for the next time, I want you to make sure you've read that first chapter, make sure that you're doing okay on it, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some more stuff. So until then, have yourself a great day. We'll see you next time. Same bad time, same bad place.